Global military spending has hit a new record. Parts of Europe saw the biggest increase since the Cold War. As the world witnesses more conflicts, can this trend be reversed? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the programme. I'm Imran Khan. Global military spending has soared to an all-time high. It reached a whopping $2.2 trillion last year, and that's according to data just published by the think tank Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, or SIPRI. It's the biggest year-on-year increase since the end of the Cold War, and there's no denying Russia's invasion of Ukraine led to an immediate surge in spending in Europe and elsewhere as countries moved to enhance their military capabilities or exported weapons and equipment to Kyiv. But let's take a closer look at the report. Now, the sharpest rise in spending was, of course, in Europe, jumping 13%, its steepest increase since 1989. And much of that was because of Ukraine, where military spending soared 640% to $44 billion. But the trend also spread to Kyiv's neighbours and any country feeling a potential threat by Russia, including Finland, Lithuania, Sweden and Poland. As for the global picture, the big spenders are the US, China and Russia, who together make up more than half the world's total. But they're nowhere near being equal. US military spending remains without a match, hitting $877 billion last year. That's three times higher than China, which has increased its spending for the past 28 years. And both are far higher than Russia, which sits in third place with $86.4 billion. But even away from the battlefields of Ukraine, there have been developments. Take Japan, for instance, which SIPRI says is going through a profound shift in its military policy from a pacifist to an active army. India is investing heavily too, increasing its drones, light tanks and other equipment. And in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia is now the fifth highest spender in the world, jumping to around $75 billion. So while Russia's invasion of Ukraine has had a clear impact, SIPRI says global military spending has been rising continuously for the last 8 years, and the data is also showing us something else.
It really is quite a fundamental shift in that 2022, not only is it the highest level of military spending ever recorded, it really reflects maybe a changing of the times, where countries really is a signaling that we're living in an increasingly insecure world, where states are essentially bolstering military strength and building security through a deterrence rather than essentially, let's say, peace, peaceful negotiations.
We've a lot to discuss. Let's bring in our guests in Washington, Elizabeth Brohr, Senior Fellow with the Foreign and Defense Policy at the American Enterprise Institute and the author of The Defender's Dilemma, Identifying and Deterring Grey Zone Aggression. In New Delhi, Major General S.B. Astana, a former Director General Infantry in the Indian Army. General Astana is also the Director of the United Service Institution of India, a National Security and Defense Services think tank. And in Berlin, Domitila Sagramosa, a Senior Lecturer in Security and Development at King's College London. A warm welcome to each of you. I'd like to begin in Washington, D.C., with Elizabeth. Elizabeth, if this report is to be believed, and the evidence is certainly there, then this is all about Ukraine, 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 and Russian aggression. That's why the world is arming. But is it as simplistic as that?
It's partly as simplistic as that. And SIPRI, the report that it releases every year into the world's arms expenditures, that is sort of the Bible that everybody in the sector uses to see where arms expenditures are going. And it is very much about Ukraine this year, but it's also about China. We are seeing increased defense expenditures in China's neighborhood in response to the worsening relations between China and its neighbors. But the most dramatic increase is clearly in Europe. I mean, 27%, 36% even in Finland. These are extraordinary figures that of growth in defense expenditure. And we should remember that for 15, 20 years after the end of the Cold War, the direction was completely the opposite. Now it's racing towards more and more expenditures.
Dobby Tiller in Berlin, here we are. We're looking at, you know, the biggest defence rise since the end of the Cold War. We're looking at almost traditional weaponry, heavy weapons, tanks, helicopters, aircraft, that kind of a thing, because of the Russian Russian war in Ukraine. But is this the right things that people should be spending their money on, given that we're in the 21st century? Cyber warfare is still something that people need to be worried about. Or are we going almost backwards, do you think?
Well, sadly, in a way, we are going backwards in terms of conflicts in the European continent. So we really do not have much of a choice. I mean, I think European publics would much prefer that governments spend money and funding on health, education, addressing climate change, transformation of industry. I mean, there we have very serious challenges. But unfortunately, the Russian invasion of Ukraine is forcing European countries to spend quite a lot, as was explained, in the military sector. So I think that this is a trend that for the next few years is not going to change, unfortunately. And although it is very sad, I think this is a reality that now European publics are coming to terms with. They are understanding that this is a necessity and that these challenges are ahead, and that Europe really benefited very much from these decades of peace in the European continent. But unfortunately, the situation now has changed. So Europeans also are becoming increasingly aware, especially at the level of government, that Europe also needs to contribute more to its own defense. The reliance on the United States is positive in some ways, but it also presents challenges. And it's very clear with the war in Ukraine that Europeans need to also increase their defense spending and provide their fair share.
Now, it's not just about Europe. It's also about China. When it comes to China, it's Pakistan, it's India. Let's bring in General Astana joining us from New Delhi. There's no way India can keep up with China's defence spending. So you've got to spend smarter. Is that what India is doing, or are you just trying to keep up?
See, as far as defence spending is concerned, every country has to decide what is the threat to that country, and thereafter structure its force structuring as well as defensive spending. As far as India is concerned, perhaps we are the only country which has two belligerent neighbors, both are nuclear powers, and with both we have the unsettled borders. And we know Chinese aggression, the way it has happened in South China Sea, the way it has happened in the way the kind of demonstrations which they keep doing in Taiwan, and the incremental encroachment strategy which China is doing in every domain, whether it is economic, digital, cyber, and you name a element of warfare, whether kinetic or non-kinetic. But that's the way China is developing. So therefore, to ensure that we maintain our sovereignty and territorial integrity, we have to spend up to a point which we feel is appropriate for us to create a credible minimum deterrence with which we can ensure our territorial integrity and sovereignty. And that is what India is doing. And that is how you would see that the Indian defense expenditure, of course, we were not fortunate enough that when we got independent, we had a big defense manufacturing sector, but we have created to some extent, but we are relying on external exporters. And it so happened that since we didn't get too much of technology from the West initially, we were overly dependent on Russia, which right. We are aware of. Therefore, you will see the difference, the kind of diversification which we have done. And therefore, you will find that it's increasingly right. Getting more on USA, France, and Israel.
Well, let me speak now to Elizabeth Broyle. You've heard what our guest in New Delhi has had to say. We're having to spend money. India is having to spend money because of the threat it faces from China, from Pakistan. However, diplomacy is still the only way, real way through this. But here we are. The world is spending more money on weapons. Is that a damage to the diplomacy that's going on, or a failure of diplomacy?
Well, I think we'd all like a world where almost no money is being spent on weapons because countries would choose to get along. But the problem is that as soon as you have one or more countries that refuse to accept other countries' territorial integrity and that behave in an aggressive way, then those other countries have to spend more, have to spend money, or including more money on defense. And that's where we are today. And so that doesn't mean that diplomacy can't coexist or can't happen at the same time as countries spend more on defense. Clearly, even when you spend more on defense as a country wishing to defend itself, then you still hope that you won't need to use your weapons. You hope that those weapons will convince the other side that it's not worth attacking. And so even while you spend that money, additional money on defense, you conduct diplomacy with belligerent countries or countries that may want to harm your country to convey the message to them that really it's not worth attacking our country because we are willing to defend ourselves. And by the way, it would be better for you in all kinds of ways not to engage in a war against us because it would be costly for you in blood and treasure. And that's these are the two parallel tracks that are happening in all these countries, both in Europe and in China's neighborhood, countries spending more on defense to communicate to better be able to defend themselves and to communicate to the other side that that is indeed the case, but also telling the other side, whether it be Russia or China, that, you know, you know, have think better thoughts, engage in more productive actions towards us because it would benefit you too and not just us.
Domitila, one of the things we hear regularly on this show and one of the things that the Russians and the Chinese say to me is the reason that we are in the position that we're in is because we have a sphere of influence. We have a sphere of influence in Eastern Europe that which the West doesn't respect, says Russia. We have a sphere of influence in Southeast Asia, the Philippines, Taiwan, etc., that the West doesn't respect either. And that's why when we want to like defend our position suddenly, people start spending money on weapons. Is there a failure of listening to China and Russia's concerns here, a traditional failure of that?
Well, I think the problem lies exactly in their narrative about, you know, the right to have spheres of influence where other countries are not allowed, according to them, to operate, where countries that find themselves in this sphere of influence are losing their sovereignty, they're losing their agency. And this is really unacceptable. And we are listening carefully to what they have to say. But, you know, we understand the security concerns. If we think about Russia in particular, there's been a lot of efforts before the war broke out in February of last year to try to find a negotiated outcome, to try to understand and address issues of security and confidence and transparency with Russia through various channels, bilaterals with the United States, through NATO, Russia Council, through the OSCE, and Russia decided to sideline these channels and to just move ahead with the use of force in Ukraine. So I think that it's very important to send the message also that we need to uphold international law, the right of sovereignty and territorial integrity of these countries. We understand that security cannot be built at the expense of other countries, of other powers. That's why it's very important to try to reconfigure the, you know, the theaters of defense and security, both in Europe and in Asia. But that cannot come at the expense of like great powers deciding the fate of smaller countries and changing the borders through the use of force. So what we are talking here is really to upholding international law and not allowing bigger powers to sort of decide the fate of smaller countries. I think that's one of the lessons that we learned from the Cold War, and the post-Cold War period was really a period where we're trying to support and sustain the sovereignty and the independent foreign policy of these countries.
General Astana, one of the roles China has played in the conflict between, and the conflicts, various conflicts between Pakistan and India and the effective Cold War that still continues between Pakistan and India, is it stopped it becoming a hot war. India has looked at China's backing almost without any kind of clauses to Pakistan, and that stopped a war. So it is useful in some way, right?
So far, in most of the wars with Pakistan, China never intervened. But the situation has changed to a great extent. Now, Chinese, with their economic engagement and CPEC getting into Pakistan, their stakes in Pakistan have increased. At the same time, you would notice that when Pakistan is continuously launching proxy war against India, Chinese, firstly, they look the other way around, and secondly, they have tried to shield a number of UN-designated terrorists too. So therefore, Pakistan is a low-cost nuisance value to India, working on behalf of China in a way. And as far as Pakistan is concerned, China is a high-value security guarantor to them. That's one issue. The second issue is that there is a Sino-Pak nexus. There is an increasing footprints of Chinese soldiers also in certain areas of Gilgit-Baltistan, which is not comfortable to us. So therefore, in future conflict, to say that Sino-Pak nexus will not work may be an understatement, although we expect that China to behave in a particular manner as they have behaved so far. That's number one. Number two, as far as Sino-India Indian confrontation is concerned, we are already having a standoff, and in that standoff, Pakistan has not intervened. So this nexus has not worked in that manner. But notwithstanding that, as far as we are concerned, they both are a threat, and to make sure that we confront a twin threat or two-front threat, we have to make sure and believe our adversaries that we can handle two-front threat. And if we can do so, then obviously there will be no two-front threat, so long they know that we can handle it.
I want to change tack now and bring in Elizabeth Brohe. I want to talk about the finances of this effectively arms race that's going on. Let's take a look at Saudi Arabia, spending billions and billions of dollars upgrading their defensive capabilities. This is good news for the business, but when there's this much money floating around, you tend to get politics involved as well. You tend to get people wanting to sell weapons. I guess what I'm asking you is, we're in a boom time, and because it's a boom time, actually rolling back on defence spending is going to be very difficult because people are making too much money, right?
People are making a lot of money, or defence companies are making a lot of money. And since you mentioned Saudi Arabia, part of the reason that Saudi Arabia has managed to establish this extraordinarily powerful position in international politics is that it has bought, not just in recent years, but over many years, a lot of defense equipment from Western arms manufacturers, well, from many kinds of arms manufacturers, even though it didn't need all that weaponry, because defense companies, especially in the West, as Western companies, Western countries, Western governments reduce defense spending, their defense companies were desperate to sell weaponry, and Saudi Arabia bought a lot of it, which of course made it very popular with Western governments. So the challenge with defense companies or arms manufacturers is that they make products that only governments can buy. So they are very dependent on whether governments are in the mood to buy defense equipment, i.e. weapons, at any given time. They can't turn to the general public and say, well, we'll expand our clientele. That doesn't work. So they go from rags to riches, or not so really extreme as to be rags, but rags to riches as the fortunes of the world wax and wane. And so what we have now is lots of Western governments catching up with defense spending, but then facing the issue that the arms makers don't have enough space in their order books to accommodate all these weapons that now Western governments and indeed many kinds of governments now want to buy.
Domitilla, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because once one country in one particular region starts to spend money, then the neighbours look at them and say, OK, we probably should do this as well. We're seeing this here in the Middle East. Qatar is almost rebuilding its own army. It's spending billions and billions of dollars. It doesn't manufacture anything domestically, so it has to buy all of these weapons in. When you're spending that kind of money, it also gives you influence with the countries you're spending that money in. The nexus between the politics influence and the money being spent is also quite heady, isn't it? So for a country like Qatar, for Saudi Arabia, it actually gives them an outsized influence whilst they're buying that weaponry, right?
Yes and no. I mean, it's not automatic. I mean, many countries are buying weaponry and then they're carrying out more independent foreign policies, and sometimes, the purchases are quite complex, as happened, in the case of Turkey was trying to buy Russian military equipment. So, and Turkey is a NATO member. So I think that, we have instances where, for example, you mentioned Saudi Arabia, which is now carrying out an energy policy which is not very favorable to the West and to the United States, because it reduced production to increase the price of oil. So, I mean, it's not necessarily a sort of an automatic sort of policy. Clearly, there are situations where countries depend very much because they are in a state of war. This is a case of Russia. It's depending very much on countries that could provide military support. In particular, it's trying to get military support from China. So in that case, you can argue that China has some leverage because, Russia is trying to find weaponry and trying to purchase it from China to carry out its military operations in Ukraine. So that in that particular situation, of course, you have a lot more leverage. The same, in a way, applies to the leverage that Western countries have over Ukraine, because Ukraine is heavily dependent on support and purchases from NATO member states and others. So, to a great extent, it creates some leverage, especially if there is a military conflict and a military situation. If there isn't this kind of military conflict or situation, the countries have a lot more room for maneuver. And so I think that, the situation is a bit more complex.
In New Delhi, General Astana, I want to ask you a question. You mentioned one of the key partners for India is Israel. Now, Israel's a very controversial partner when it comes to buying weapons from, because of the battle testing it does with those weapons in, for example, the Gaza Strip every time there is a war. There is a political consideration here as well when you're buying weaponry. It's who you're buying those weapons from. Is it simply a matter of can we get them at the best price possible and most effective, or is there a political consideration?
As far as India is concerned, let me tell you in no uncertain terms, it is purely and squarely what meets our qualitative requirement of the weapon. And in that, we have a system of global tender. Whoever gives the tender, irrespective of what everybody has to go through a trial, because we have a variety of terrain in the country where the equipment is going to be employed. And therefore, it may well happen that USA Javelin doesn't qualify and Israeli's spy qualifies. So these are certain, I would say it's purely done as per our qualitative requirement and not as per the politics. Politics can be very well covered by media, and it's a different game. But as a professional, I can tell you in no uncertain terms, because a fair amount of equipment was purchased when I happened to be on the chair. But let me tell you that we don't compromise on that quality part of it. Secondly, when it comes to our requirements has to be not only the operational requirement, terrain requirement, but also an area to become self-reliant. So we look for a country who is ready to do some transfer of technology so that we can't keep buying weapons from outside forever.
Sorry, General, we are running out of time. Now, I want to come to our other guests as well. Elizabeth, let me just make that point to you. It's a business decision for India to where it buys its weapons from. It's that, and that's all it is, says General Astana. But there is a political decision-making process as well. You can't divorce the two, particularly within the West. There's simply too many people that will say too many different things. But ultimately, when you're selling weapons, when you're buying weapons, is it just about the business?
It's not just about the business aspect. And I think this is what makes weapons different from military weaponry different from any kind of other product that you could possibly sell as a company, because you're selling it to a government. And in a sense, if you are a weapons manufacturer, you represent the country in which you are based. So let's say you're an American weapons manufacturer, for better or worse, good and ill, you represent America. That is often an advantage, because America's allies want to buy American weaponry, because then they have the same weaponry as the U.S. armed forces. That makes everything very easy. And they also buy themselves friendship in Washington. But you also have the disadvantage that you can't really sell to China or to Russia, because the U.S. government would prevent that. So there are always political overtones. Now, India is, in a sense, a special case, because as always, has always said it's free to buy weapons from whomever it likes, and has bought from Russia, has bought from many others. But that is more the exception, and most countries stick with friendly countries from whom they buy most of their weaponry.
Dobby Tiller, very quickly, because we are running out of time, but I just want to come to you. There's simply too much money involved when it comes to selling arms to actually have any other consideration other than money. Surely.
Yes, of course. I mean, there is a geostrategic or geopolitical consideration. If we consider, for example, the sales of Russian military equipment within what we call the Collective Security Treaty Organization, Russia was selling equipment at lower prices than the market, and these countries were benefiting from this relationship, and Russia was helping them to develop their armed forces throughout the years. And you know, helping them with military training and so on. So certainly, I mean, there is a political security dimension which is tied to many of these sales, as was explained by the other speakers. And I think this is totally understandable, because you also want to have compatibility, interoperability, and the war in Ukraine is clearly showing the challenges when you have a partner like Ukraine, which relies primarily on Russian and former Soviet equipment, and we in the West, in NATO, we don't have. Some countries in the East do have former Soviet ammunition and equipment, but others do not. You know, we rely on Western equipment and technology. So when you try to help this partner, you're trying to find globally sources of ammunition that can help, the war machine. So that complicates matters. And it clearly shows how much easier it is when countries in a particular alliance share the similar sort of technology, arms industries, and compatibility of products.
I want to thank all our guests, Elizabeth Raw, Major General S.B. Astana, and Dobby Tiller Sagramosa. And I want to thank you as well for watching. Now, you can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. And you can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. From me, Imran Khan, and the entire team here in Doha, bye for now.